Hi, welcome to the movies. I thought I'd put up a fun picture up there. I'm going to have to stop turning around. This is kind of the classic view of C++, right? It's fast, it's just not necessarily the easiest language out there. Now, I was going to start off today by asking, you know, how many of you are gurus of C++, or how many of you have been at it for a while, or some of you hopefully never. But I can't really see how many hands would go up exactly, but I'll still ask, all right? So is everybody here kind of an expert in C++? No? Good. Then again, I think no one can really be a true expert, right? How many people here have never used C++? One? Okay. Two? So hopefully we'll be somewhere in the middle, and there'll be something for everybody in today's talk. So the impetus for today is that we have a new standard coming. The ISO committee has received a draft last month, and so if all goes well at this point, we can safely say that we will have a new C++ standard this year. And the name, because we're not very original, is C++ 11, or 2011. This is the one we used to call C++ 0x, because it took so many years to make. We thought it was going to come out in, you know, the 2000s of some kind. And then the X became hexadecimal, and now it's 11. But at least it's done, and it's a pretty big deal. It's a huge standard. This is the most significant changes to the language since the 90s, since the introduction of templates. And there's so much to cover that there's no way I can tell you all about it. And so in thinking about what to talk about, what is the most relevant pieces, I've tried to think about what is C++ really good for? What is its value? And the best answer that our team has at this point is it's about power and performance on any platform. I'm not going to spread the line of, like, it's all about only Windows. The reality is we live in a heterogeneous world. There's a lot of kinds of devices. And if you want to get the maximum power and performance from any device, C++ is the best choice. So what do we mean by power and performance? So when I think of power, I think of, you know, unlimited access. If you want to use any piece of hardware that is attached to your machine or that is inside your machine, you can. Whether it's having to drop down in C or, you know, being able to use it at a nicer level in C++, the fact is you don't need to wait for someone to wrap the APIs. If it can plug into the computer, chances are you can talk to it in native code. And that's what power means. We would never change C++ in such a way that you would not be able to use every aspect of the machine. That goes against the philosophy of the language. Now, performance, that's the bread and butter of native languages, yeah? So having the best speed possible is what performance is about. And that's the definition of that is changing as we enter a more kind of parallel world. But the fact remains that the goal and ethos of C++ is about speed. On any platform, like I said, is simply a statement about the fact that it's a standard, the fact that it, by definition, we try to compile it on all of our platforms, and we do, and then others make sure that the language works elsewhere. So if you don't like having, you know, things preventing you from accessing machines, C++ is the only way to be high level and yet fast and on every platform. So I figured I could get a couple of quotes that would say it better. And these are from Bjarne Stroustrup, the inventor of the language, talking about the new standard. And what I thought was interesting is he's basically stating that we're now closer to having that high-level abstraction without the loss of efficiency and native access to the machine. And this is kind of important, right? Because as you try to be more and more productive, and you have to write code using more interesting constructs, and it's nice to know that you can do those things in C++ without compromising on performance. And this was a more interesting quote for me, which is, if you approach C++ the way you did in the 90s, you're not going to get kind of the most out of it anymore. The language has definitely changed a lot. It kind of grew out of, you know, compatibility with C, and then let's add kind of new programming paradigms, not just object orientation, but genericity. But the fact is, it's really evolved, and it has, you know, unique value that if you start from a C approach, you're not going to see it. So his argument here is that we should actually change the way we teach the language. And now I can't necessarily achieve that in one session, but I'm going to give it a try. So I'm going to go over some of the base concepts. I'm not going to go through, you know, what a for loop is. But I'm not going to just focus on what's new in C++ 2011, but kind of look at that through the prism of basic functionality that the language provides and what are kind of unique capabilities in the language. So the very first thing, which I think is probably at the core of what makes a C++ developer productive, which is programming with values. Now, who can tell me what a value is in terms of programming? You can just shout it out. Anybody? It's a tough word, I guess. No, sorry, I got an answer over here. Primitive. It's a primitive. A value is a primitive. That's a really good definition. In most languages, you can only get value semantics and get value from a primitive, so integers and things like this. But that's not the only definition. A value, I think, you could define it as something that has no state, right? It doesn't define the storage for the data. It's the data itself. That's a value. Now, in modern languages, people use this term in all sorts of different ways. It's used in functional programming a bunch. Because a lot of times there you're working with immutable values. And to keep it simple, I think of it as either no state, or if you have state, finding a way to provide your deep copy semantics, otherwise you don't have the right meaning when you use those variables. Well, sorry, those values. Now in C++, one of the great things about the language, again in its philosophy, was as a user, you should be able to experience user-defined types as in the same way as built-in types. So in many languages, you will never be able to use your type the way you use a primitive. That's why your comment is pretty spot on. But in C++, you can. In C++, a user type can completely mimic a primitive. Now, why is this kind of neat and important? Well, look at this code. This is C# code, okay? Although it could be almost anything. This looks ridiculous, I think, to most people. Everybody agree? Like, you would not check for null on an int. And in fact, this would in C#, this will compile with a warning, telling you this is a useless comparison. And in C++, this would fail to type check if you used a null pointer. But let's take a look at this code. Now, this looks the same. And of course you would check for null. So what makes bar and int so different? And in a lot of languages, it's simply the fact that you didn't define it, and all classes derive from kind of a base object. And to support all that polymorphism, they are not treated as values. They're treated as references and variables. So in C++, you don't have to do this. You can have bar operate just like it did on the left side. And in fact, that's how this code should behave in C++ if you wrote your own bar type. So now let's put this in practice. Right? How do we want to put this in practice? I'm going to create an arena. This is going to be our demo today. And we're going to have a bunch of fighters that fight each other. So we're going to define this fighter type. Okay. And at its simplest level, a fighter would have a name and some health, right? Some kind of health value. If you define it like this, It just works. This is not that impressive. This is what in C++ people tend to call plain old data. And in C Sharp, there are very similar constructs as well with value types. Now, that initialization will work, and that assignment will work. And it will do the right thing. Now, the reason is the compiler is able to generate the right code given how, given that it's just data. And in fact, string is not just data, but string knows how to copy itself. But that's cheating right now. Let's not think about that. Now, what if we wanted more from this fighter class? We wanted, for example, to have dynamic data. Maybe he has his bag of loot, yeah, and we need to create that dynamically, and it's going to be it's a resource that we'll have to manage that way. If I added that in and didn't create a constructor, then you know it wouldn't even initialize the data. But the bigger problem now is that copy from Lisa to Bart, from Bart to Lisa, doesn't work anymore. At least it doesn't do the right thing. It creates a shallow copy, right? Because the pointer for data won't like walk the whole data set and copy it in. So what do we do now? Now we've broken the value semantics, and you can't use fighter the way you'd expect to. You can't use it like an int. So you have to do a bit more work. This is what I meant by you can achieve the value semantics, which is a really powerful thing. It just requires a little bit of forethought. So let's walk through what it means to make a C++ type that is usable like a value. So the first thing is we need to find a way to copy it correctly. Right? You need the deep copy semantics. So the way I would do that is by adding a copy constructor. So it takes a reference to another fighter. That's the function you see there. And just takes all of its members and copies through the data. So it takes a copy of the name, a copy of the health, creates its own new data, and then copies all of the data in. And now you have a new fighter. So this should work, right? Now you still need to be able to assign into one. So copying and assigning is a little bit different. But that's not a big difference. So to complete this, you just need to add an assignment operator, which is what you see at the bottom. And I implemented it in terms of swap, so it's kind of clear. So we have this swap function, which just knows how to steal from one to the other. And so it takes the fighter on the right and takes all of its members and just swaps them with the ones on the left. So what the assignment operator is doing is simply saying, let me copy the fighter that was passed to me. So that's the parameter, fighter, O. And from that copy, I'm going to swap myself with all of its elements. And that doesn't create a second guy, or a second fighter, because you're kind of an empty shell and you're just grabbing all of its members. But you'll still get a copy, that's the whole point. But the copying is happening actually in the parameter list, right? The compiler is generating it for you. So this is great. Now we have a giant dynamic array that is copied over. And this works correctly. I can use this in that original code without having to worry about its behavior. Now, this is great. And anyone who's programmed in C++ for a while must notice that there's something missing here, right? Something I must have forgotten that's really important. Okay, I'll give you a hint. It's not the last thing here that I was expecting. This is the new part. This is saying, well, what if it's really expensive to make that copy? And I want to just, you know, swap the pointers and just move all of that data across when I can. So sometimes you need a copy, right? So if I go back, Bart and Lisa should both exist at the end of that assignment. But the fighter that comes out of the helper function, getFighter, it's creating one and then passing it into Kirk. That one doesn't need to live on, right? It's going to disappear as soon as I exit from that scope. So that temporary object doesn't, you know, deserve to have its own, to create a whole copy. What I really need to do is create its data and then steal it when I give it to Kirk. That's kind of the way you want to operate in terms of being efficient while still providing the right semantics. So this was an area where C++ up until now gave you the ability to have the right semantics in terms of copying, which is necessary to be a value, but wasn't efficient in so many cases. And that's a really big problem, and most people kind of then didn't use this technique, which is really, really at the core of C++. So with C++ 11, we now have the ability to use these R-value references as parameters. So I have here at the bottom a constructor that takes an R-value. An R-value, think of it as something that cannot be assigned to. So it's another way of saying in many cases it's just a temporary. I can take its data because no one else will ever look at it. So what I do in this constructor is say, create nothing for my data, you know, like the head points to nothing, so I don't create all this huge data, and then swap the pointers. And it's a very efficient way of getting the stuff out of O without having to copy it all. So this is great. Now we have, you know, really, really efficient way of using, of doing deep copies of values in a lot of cases. Where this becomes really powerful is using containers. So when you put something in a vector, which is kind of the main kind of container used in C++ programs, well, the vector deals with size for you, right? Just like a list or in .NET, you can keep appending things into it, it'll be fine. But what that means is it needs to resize. It's not a linked list, so it doesn't just attach another one and another one. It's backed by like an array structure, and it has to grow. And so if I go from 8 objects and I add another, we'll probably grow to 16, and I may have to move stuff around inside my data in the vector. And that should be transparent to you, and it is. But what it's really doing is using the value semantics to copy the objects around. And if you can provide your type with a move constructor, which is what I have there at the bottom, then it can move those elements around, which is much, much cheaper. So now putting them into a vector, you wouldn't do what a lot of people tend to do, which is make it a vector of pointers to your object. You can make it a vector of your object. And it's really, really powerful. So, like I said, I still forgot something. We're close to kind of the default, you know, template for a type, but there's one more thing missing that's super, super important. And what I think is probably the single best feature of C++, and it's not even new. In fact, it hasn't changed much at all. It has to do with garbage. So, how many people here like garbage collection or .NET? I'm a big fan, so feel free to raise your hand. Okay. So garbage collection is an amazing invention. It's not new anymore. I don't know if we can call it an invention or just part of, you know, day-to-day programming for most people now. And what it does really, really well is takes care of memory. Now, what it doesn't do is take care of every other kind of resource. It basically made memory special for good reason. We use memory more than anything else. But it doesn't solve managing any other kind of resource, at least not in the way that those resources need to be managed. So whether it's file handles or you know, sockets, there's all sorts of things like that that are resources that are finite, just like memory, but that are not managed by the GC itself. Now, why is that important? Well, having a, you know, I read this great quote that said, you know, having a garbage collector is like having someone sweeping the streets. And I've been walking around, and it's clear that even though someone sweeps the streets, you're not throwing stuff on the ground, yeah? It's not an excuse to be lazy and just throw stuff away. And this is true even, you know, for really good managed programs, you actually have to pay attention to the speed and the way in which you're allocating things and using new resources. So let's be concrete. Let's take an example and compare C# and C++. So this is writing out to a file. People, you all must have done this at some point in your careers. So is anything wrong with the code at the top? This is C# code. Anyone? There's no closing of the file? Is there a foo? There's a foo. It's not a file. Well, I did that to do that. I actually did that on purpose. I fooled myself. Foo is an alias to file, and I did that so that you think about this code in a generic sense. Like, you might see this anywhere in the wild, but it's really just an alias to file in when I was writing the code. So it worked. It fooled me. I forgot. So, but I didn't close foo, right? I didn't close the file. In fact, when I see foo, I don't even know that I should be closing it. And this is an interesting problem, right? As a consumer of an API, how do you even know that you might need to close or release that resource? How do you know that there's a resource backing that class? That's not in the type definition in .NET, right? Or in Java, for that matter. So what do you do? And in C++, if you look at the code below, that's actually C style. I'm creating a file pointer, and same thing there. I don't know that I need to release that handle. It's not clear there either. So in both of these pieces of code, there's something that you need to do as a consumer that is not made obvious to you. And that's just not really great API design. So the first thing you could do, right, as you walk through this is you might say, well, the file API, the foo, it raises exceptions, and I should probably catch those. So you could write code like this. I could create a null foo and then open the file. See, it's like I'm file and foo, so I'm having fun with it. And I can catch any exceptions that come out of that and write them out and then throw back to the next guy. And then figure out that I have to have a finally block, and that's where I do the closing of my resource. Now, this is not super intuitive. You'd have to probably read some documentation in order to do this right. The compiler doesn't tell you to do this, right? It doesn't force you, especially not with the exceptions. And it's not even fine-grained in the sense that without the finally, you wouldn't be closing necessarily in the right spot. So this is why finally is really key. On the C++ side, it's not that much better. The only difference here is I don't use finally. I just finish the scope and close the file there. At least I separate the two exceptions here, but that's because the first API doesn't even use exceptions. So you use this mix. It's not ideal. So how do we make this better, right? So in C# and in most languages that I've ever used, the solution to this problem is giving nicer syntax to the consumer to do what's on the left. And that's this, right? So using is this keyword in C#, with is the keyword in Python. Like, a lot of languages implement this concept because they realize that they need to clean up resources correctly. And they don't want to have every API user figure out what is the right way to close the thing or release the thing. So here, when you go using in C#, right, it's going to call the dispose function for you, which will close the file. Now, when is that going to be called? Now, what line of code here? Does anyone know? Is it going to be called where my cursor is, leaving the example function? Is that where it'll be called? Anyone think that's the case? No. It's garbage collected. You can't predict when it's going to happen. But it will happen. So that's an interesting guarantee, right? When you use using, we guarantee that the resource is going to be finalized. You just don't know when. So you don't have to worry about it not closing. You just have to worry about when, which can be a problem, especially for very contentious resources. And this could be anything from the sockets on your machine, the GPU, even maybe the disk. The disk, arguably, is not as contentious, but maybe lots of different people are trying to write to this file, and you want to make sure it closes. Now, in C++, that's the code to fix this. And you'll notice that I'm using a different file. I'm not using the file that was there before, the handle. And I'll show you the implementation of that, which follows from the one we just did. But I think you'll notice that there's no work on you, the consumer. So when you're using this file API, you don't have to think about how it releases itself. It will. If that's what it needs to do underneath, it will. And so I think this is by far the most kind of powerful feature in the language. So here's what the file type would look like. And it follows very much kind of what we did with the fighter, with the caveat that at least this time I put in a destructor, which I didn't on the other one, which would be terrible, and it was leaking lots of data there. And all I'm doing in the destructor is saying close the resource. And whatever resources a class is managing, it will close in its destructor. Now, to some of you, this is like old hat, right? A lot of C++ kind of know-how has gone into this, and this is colloquially termed RAII. Resource acquisition is initialization. And it has the corollary, which is resource release is destruction. And so what that means is, if you create a class, a type, over one resource, and when you construct your class, you acquire that resource, and when you destruct your class, you release that resource, then that becomes really, really, really powerful and easy in subsequent code using it. It composes really well, because if I put two files on the stack there, they'll both be closed correctly. Even if one of them succeeds and then the next one throws exceptions, the first one will unwind correctly. In fact, it'll do it in the reverse order of construction. And all of that happens automatically at the closing of the function, right? That's when the scope goes away, and that's when everything gets cleaned up. So it's not a ton of work, right? What I'm doing here is a constructor, a destructor, a move constructor you noticed here, the second function. And you'll notice that I forgot to make it call swap, but you would call swap inside. And there is no way to copy my file API. So I've embedded the non-copyability of a file into my class. So as an API, this becomes really, really powerful, right? Really well designed. I can put a file anywhere. I can use it like a value. I can put it in on the stack and pass it. And as long as it can do that without copying the file itself, which will be figured out at compile time, then it works. So it makes your consuming API, your consuming code very, very robust in the face of exceptions or in the face of just kind of using things in containers and moving things around. All of that will just work, and it'll be safe. So I can't kind of stress this enough. If you're already familiar with this, then I apologize for kind of wasting your time for 10 minutes. All you need to know if you've already seen this and you're familiar with it is that move semantics are new and enable you to use these techniques on kind of a whole new set of data types that cannot be copied or for which the copy is really, really expensive. But what it really is important for everyone who hasn't used this technique, and really why you should absolutely be using this only and all the time, anytime you see a free resource on your machine that where you had to, when you're coding and there's like, you have a close or a release or anything like that, you should take 10 minutes, wrap that resource in a class like that, and keep going. And your code will become a lot cleaner, a lot smaller, and a lot more correct. And another point, when I talk about this, I mentioned a lot about things about safety and correctness, but it's also a value in terms of performance. So an old myth is that creating all these objects on the stack or these copies can be very expensive all in all, especially when a lot of people compare the allocation model on a garbage collection language versus a native language, and definitely there's some differences there that might make you think GC will be faster when you create a lot of these. But the reality is, the destructor semantics, which means as soon as you exit that block where that object was put on the stack, you will release its resources, actually gives you way better cache locality. And oddly enough, cache locality is more important now than it was a decade ago or two decades ago. Because the performance differential between leaving cache and not leaving the cache is actually far greater now. Because the clock speeds of your computers are such that, you know, leaving the CPU to go get something even from memory, from RAM, is so many cycles. When if you go back to the space shuttle, you know, exiting the CPU in terms of number of cycles that the CPU would do was not a lot. So the speed at which CPUs have improved relative to memory and disk has caused this to become a bigger problem. And caches don't grow, right? They're still really, really tiny. So finding ways to stay in the cache and to maintain good cache locality is arguably, you know, in many cases, more important than having a good algorithm. If your algorithm has good cache locality, it will probably outperform a, you know, better designed algorithm up to a certain size. And that's kind of a serious situation. Okay. So that's destructors, and that's resources. Now, I'm about to put this all together in a demo so that we can go and play with some code. And, you know, we have these building blocks, right? So I can work with things as values. I have this determinism in how things are acquired and released. How does that play into actually doing something that's higher level? Right? Types is great, and that's kind of, you've been doing that for forever. But in our day and age, if you want to be productive, it's really about higher level abstractions. And again, C++ always had the goal of providing high level abstractions without sacrificing efficiency and performance. And I'm not going to spend my time showing you, you know, readouts of the compiler-generated x86, but I guess you can trust me that it's still generating code that is really not indirected in most cases. So what is unique in terms of how C++ approaches higher-level programming? Well, the first thing is that it doesn't limit itself to object-oriented. In fact, you could argue that it doesn't even do object-oriented, you know, perfectly right. I'm personally a very big fan of Smalltalk, and I like the way kind of messages are passed in Smalltalk, and C++ doesn't do that way, neither does C#. But it still provides you the ability to do object orientation. Right? If you want to have polymorphism on that fighter and have different kinds of fighters and still have all that great behavior, you can. But it also allows you to do generic programming, functional programming. None of these things necessarily perfectly in comparison to specialized languages, but still abstract enough and efficient, which is what most other languages sacrifice. So let's take one example of what I mean by kind of the C++ spin on some of these higher level concepts. So one of the great new things in C++ 11 is for functional programming, is the ability to create lambda expressions, right? To write lambda expressions. Now, C++ already had kind of ways of achieving the result through function objects, functors, but this really makes it a lot easier. And then coupled with C++'s existing kind of ability to treat functions as first class, this starts to become very powerful. So let's take an example. Here's some C# code, and it's not doing anything special. It's creating a bunch of actions, and an action is just a function that takes nothing and returns nothing. And then it executes a bunch of actions. So what am I going to see on the screen? What am I going to see printed out? Sorry? 0 to 9? 0 to 9. No? What am I going to see? 10 nines. That's right. You're going to see 10 nines. So I bring this up because this is something about C sharp that you have to kind of learn. So the lambda expression is really cool, and it's an amazing tool for achieving kind of great stuff. But it comes with a bunch of pitfalls, right? A lot of danger. You have to understand why you're not getting the value 0, 1, 2, 3. You're getting the last value. And that's because it's not actually capturing the value in that lambda. It's capturing the state, but it's hoisting those as variables and referring to the same variable. So if you wanted to get the data, if you wanted to get the value, you'd have to do this. You'd have to make a copy. And it gets worse. What if counter was not a primitive, right? Counter was a foo or a bar, like in our previous example. Then going, you know, foo copy equals counter wouldn't even copy the counter. So you'd have to do a lot more. You'd have to do a new. You'd have to go foo copy equals new, you know, foo with the value counter. This is a lot of work, and, you know, this is a design decision on C sharp, which I understand, because in a lot of cases, the implicit capture is kind of the right way, and everything's a pointer, and people are kind of used to it. But the fact is, it led to code that you couldn't immediately necessarily understand. So in C++, we have lambdas. So how are we going to tackle this problem? C++, remember, we care a lot about value semantics and letting you work with types as if they were a basic, a primitive. So here's how it looks in C++. First of all, allow me to point out that it's not really like tons more lines of code. It's pretty much the same, plus or minus maybe a few things. And those will get better as we implement more and more of the standard. So what you see here is I have a list of actions in a vector. And the actions are just a function in this case. That's the terminology we have. And function is a type in C++11 that we already have available in the compiler today and in our library, which essentially wraps all forms of callable things. So it could be a function pointer. It could be a member function pointer. It could be a functor. It could be a lambda. So it's really nice because I can pass in whatever I want, anything that's callable, and it'll just work. It's a very, very useful type. And so what I'm doing is I'm pushing back a new lambda expression, right, that I'll demystify in a second for those that haven't done these before in C++, and I'm outputting the value of the counter. Now, this will behave the same way as the original C# code because I made it explicit. You see that square bracket section with the ampersand? This is the kind of unique approach that C++ has for lambdas. What that's saying is, don't just capture my scope implicitly. I want to capture it by reference. So whatever I use inside this lambda that I need, I want you to capture a reference to it. This would be the same thing as passing it like a const int ref. Make sense? Now, using equal, I could go the other way. Equal, I'm saying, pass me the things I use by value. And if you think of this in a function, it would mean like taking a parameter of type int. So in one case, it's like constant reference. In the other case, just an int. And by and large, you know, those are the two types of parameters you would take in a function, right? Either you're taking by value, or you're kind of ideally just observing a reference to the thing. And the other, you know, all the other things that you can take, like pointers and non-const references, all those things, you should be careful. Those should be your two defaults. So what this does now is it'll print out 0, 1, 2, 3 because it's taking a copy of counter. Now, this is really useful in that it's not just for primitives. This will just work. So anything that is properly implemented, like that file, like our fighter, If you say equal, you'll get a copy. And if you say ampersand, you're going to get a reference. And if you can't take a copy because something is not copyable, then it won't work. You'll have to take a reference. And that's kind of how it works for a Lambda in C++. So this is what I meant by we still focus on giving you control and efficiency while providing higher level abstractions. So this is not, you know, a lot of colleagues that don't have any experience with the language, when I first showed them Lambdas, they tend to, you know, get scared, their eyes go big, they're like, what are all these characters? But I hope it makes it seem like it's not that kind of mystical, and yes, it's maybe a lot of characters following one another, but Lambda expressions tend to have that behavior in general. So let me pop over to some code, and then we'll put this all together and have some fun with it. Can everyone read the fonts? Is that big enough? Yeah? In the back? Okay. So we're going to create a game. I mean, I have most of the code here. We'll walk through it, and then we'll add some extra stuff. But we're going to create a game that, you know, creates an arena, and then in that arena, there's a bunch of fighters that will fight. Nothing terribly complicated. At the core of this is our fighter type. And it's very much based on what we were looking at in those slides. So I have a name. I have an unordered map of stats. So an unordered map is also new in C++, and it's a hash table. That's it. It's been in Visual C++ since 2008 SP1, and it's kind of the library component. It's one of the library components of the new standard. So the new standard comes with language changes and library changes. The reason it's called unordered map is, and this is also very classic for the C++ committee, because we're so late to add a hash table to our standard library, the committee was worried about other people's names for their own hash tables. So you would figure after all these years, 15 years of C++ and not having a hash table, everyone's implemented their own hash table. And in fact, Microsoft's provided a custom hash table in our library for a decade, HashMap. And so they went for unordered map thinking this was probably a name no one had. And it still exemplifies kind of the behavior. So this is sometimes the sacrifices you make by, you know, focusing on compatibility in general. So I have a vector of loot. This is my, you know, my data. And let's create my fighter. So this is my constructor, nothing terribly interesting. One thing I want to point out is this random stat function. C++ OX, also, or C++ 11, I'm having trouble adapting. The name is really new. We're calling it, some of us actually debated keeping it as OX just forever. So in it, there are also new libraries for random functions, doing random pseudo generation of numbers. Now, that doesn't seem terribly fancy, but a full implementation of all the things you want to do with random number generation is actually a lot of work, and it's very error prone. So being properly random and using the latest best algorithms for generating random numbers, making sure that you're seeding it correctly, and making sure that it meets the distribution that you want to meet. So maybe you want a normal distribution rather than a uniform distribution. All these kinds of things are now built in. So here's an example of a uniform int generator, you know, with a range that I provide. So this is going to generate ints in the range 1 to 100 with, here's a seed, and this is the algorithm effectively. So there's three pieces, and then I can just generate. And that algorithm is a typedef to a pre-built one, which is called the Mersenne Twister. This is apparently, you know, I'm not an expert in this space, but that is kind of the current best random number generator algorithm. So we build that into the library, you should use it. So I'm going to generate some random stats, and here's the remainder of my type kind of constructors. There's the R value move constructor. You can ignore those squiggles there. There is the assignment operator that takes fighter by value. There's my destructor, which does nothing in this case. And then there's the swap function. And you'll notice that I made the copy constructor private. This is how you make something non-copyable, just like the file class. Now, how is this working, right? So I'm assigning and taking fighter by value. Now, taking something by value usually means a copy. But the compiler's smart, and the standard allows the compiler to be smart in a couple of cases. And the specific cases are if a function is taking something by value, a parameter by value, and the caller of that function is passing in a temporary, in other words, an R value, the compiler will do the coercion and actually pass in the R value. Which is really, really great. So your existing functions that assume getting a value don't have to do anything special to handle R values. This is, again, one of those cases where, you know, you have to think about it just a little bit up front, and you're set. And then the compiler will do the rest. So now if you have something that's f of 1, you know, the number 1, the literal 1, and you can take an R value of int, like, that's what you'll get. The compiler will do it for you. Now, you'll notice, like I said, the destructor is empty. It actually has no data to delete. And this is kind of the holy grail of C++. You want to aim towards the majority of your code having empty destructors. And you definitely want to have most of your code not calling delete. So in all of this game, all this thing, I have zero calls to delete. And these three members will clean themselves up automatically. They are themselves well-designed kind of things with destructors. So if the vector has allocated stuff, it will be destroyed. And that's what we'll see as we play around the game. So I have my little CPP file, and we'll play around in there. So the thing I love to do with lambdas, even though it's totally silly, is I find it a fun way of creating a shell. So my game is going to be this controller, and it's a shell where, you know, I have a map of strings to functions that are my commands. And there's a command already in there called create, and there's a command called close. And you'll notice I'm just assigning right into the map using a lambda expression. This just works. And what I'm doing is I'm saying create an arena and close an arena by removing it from my list of arenas. So I can create lots of arenas, even though we only need one. So this arena also exhibits kind of an interesting piece of functionality that I've had all over the code here, which is smart pointers. So what do you do when you need to be able to copy things around, but the underlying resource is not copyable? So you want to have things that are passed by value that are more than temporary, but the underlying resource is non-copyable, as an example, or is very, very expensive to copy. So to that effect, C++ has three built-in smart pointers. And you should live with them. You should use them. These are part of your bread and butter now. And again, they've been in the product for over a release now. And these are unique pointer, which I'm using here, shared pointer, and weak pointer. So unique pointer is exactly what it sounds like. It's kind of a strong term. It's I am dynamically allocating something, but it's mine, and no one else can ever own this. It cannot escape me unless I do something very, very explicit, which is I can get at the raw, you know, pointer by doing like a get. So I'm pushing back into a vector a new arena. So this is dynamically allocated, but it's in a pointer that will manage its lifetime. And unique pointers are not copyable. They're just movable. So as the vector gets resized and stuff, it'll just move these unique pointers around. That's on purpose. We don't want them to be copyable. In order to copy, you use the shared pointer. So I'll show you what that looks like, because I have one in here. I have shared pointers in my arena, right? So I typedefed a shared pointer of fighter to fighter pointer. And what that looks like is now I have a vector of fighters. Now, if I had made that a vector of fighter, that's the value, as opposed to fighter, a shared pointer to the value, then as the code I wanted to write, I want to pull fighters out of the arena, have them fight, put them back in, and you know, when they die, I want to remove them from the arena, right? All these kinds of things. And so if you think about that with, if they were just like ints, then there'd be no sense of identity, right? I'd just be pulling one out, it'd be a new copy, writing one in, be a new copy. And what that's not really what I want, especially since my fighters might have like really expensive data underneath. What I want is to be able to copy something around, but all I want to get incremented or copied is that I'm using this type. So that's what a shared pointer does. Shared pointer is just saying, anytime you take it by value, you're just, you know, you're making a copy and it adds another ref count. It's a form of collection. It's a form of memory management or resource management, but it's deterministic. And we'll see what that means when I launch this. So let me launch this. Hopefully you can read that too. So we have our shell, right? And I can go create. So that constructs an arena. And what I'm then going to call is close. And so what you see is close is not managing memory, right? It's simply saying, pop out this arena from my list of arenas. That's all. And as soon as I go close, with no delay, all of that gets destroyed, including the fighters that were created inside that arena. So the arena is a vector of fighters, or pointers to fighters, and the game is a vector of pointers to arenas, and the memory is just managed correctly for me, and deterministically. And that's really key. If this, we could write exactly the same code in C#. In fact, it would look the same, more or less. And what would happen after I pop it out of that list, it would have no longer anyone pointing to it, and at the next kind of round of GC, all that would get taken care of. Which, again, is great for memory up to a point, but it's not great for resources. So if all these fighters were holding onto a file that they were writing out like a log to, you want them to let go of that as soon as possible. There's very little value in having those live on past that curly brace. So let's play around and add a new feature, which I think is the key here. We're going to have them fight. So adding a new command would be no different than saying, well, here, let's go. We'll call this one war. So I'm capturing, this is an interesting special capture. I'm capturing this pointer, right, effectively, which is the current class and all the members of this class. Because instead of capturing the members, you can actually capture your current class. And this captures by value. It's a copy of the pointer. That's kind of the funny part. So it's a copy, but it's a copy of an address. So it's, you know, it's not actually duplicating any data. So it takes no parameters. This is an optional thing. If it took parameters, then I would need to put it in. And that's all I need to write to do some empty one. And so what we want to do is we want them to fight to the death. So I have, if I go arenas, whoops, and I can take the current, you know, that one, and I can go, whoops, right? And I can say fight to the death. I have an actual function, I already made it, called fight to the death. It returns a string, but I can capture that automatically without having to think about what it returns. So this is the ability to do type inference, which is really key if you're writing all these kind of generic things, whether that is lambdas that, you know, you don't exactly know their type. So I'll show you an example of that. Or if you're using a container, let's say you want to loop through a bunch of fighters in an arena, and you don't want to think about, as a consumer, as the person who's saying, go through each element of this list, you don't want to think about what kind of list it is. That should be abstracted from you. That was the whole point of kind of the C++ algorithm iterator container kind of approach. So the way you achieve that is with auto. So you'll go, get me the iterator at the beginning of the container, but I don't have to think about what kind of iterator it is. It'll just be automatically inferred by the compiler. So that's pretty powerful. So, and then what we want to do is, let's say S is victorious. Whoops. Right? So let me run this so we see what that does, and then we'll take a look. So create, and then war. And as we go along, a bunch of fights are happening, and fighters are losing, and fighters are being destroyed. And then one fighter is victorious. And so that's when fighter 7 gets destroyed, because he won, but he's still around. So let me show you the code so this becomes clear. So fight to the death is saying, select, you know, cause a fight to happen, which is this while true, and we'll go into that fight function. Assign the loser and the winner into two, you know, smart pointers, right? Right here. And I'm using this tuple approach. So the fight function returns a tuple of two fighters, could be a tuple of three fighters, and I'm just assigning those values into those two variables. And basically, if the loser's health is now down to zero, we'll kill the loser. And if there's only one fighter left, if fighter's size is one, we'll return the winner. So let's take a look at fight, because that's really the fun function. So first of all, it returns a tuple, also a new type in C++. What it does is, first, it wants to select two fighters at random from our list of all the fighters, right? So we have 10 fighters. I want to pick two at random. So the way I implemented that, you know, I went to a search engine. I said, how do you do picking two elements at random from a list? And basically, you iterate through the list. And as you go from the first to the next to the third to the fourth, you have a decaying probability that that person will be selected, right? So as you reach the end, you'll for sure, if you haven't picked anyone and there's I need to pick two and there's only two people left in my list, I'm definitely going to pick them. There's going to be a 100% probability. And the way I implemented that is saying, of all the remaining fighters, give me a random number. So 0 to, let's say, 100 is our first. That's the size of our number of fighters. How many fighters do I need to do a fight? I need two fighters to do a fight. So am I less than two? Yes, you're selected. And as it becomes 99, 98, 97, that's what happens. And the reason I wanted to illustrate this is capturing needed and remaining by reference. And it has to. Otherwise, you would be getting, this would just not work, right? Needed would go minus minus. But each lambda in this list, right? This is a functional kind of for each. This is effectively a map function from functional world. I'm saying for every value in fighter, do this. And what I'm doing is accumulating the results in this new container. So the reference capture is really necessary. It's not like we could live with only value-based capture. So we pick two guys, and then we want to compare their strength. So I need to have, you know, a way to compare them. And this is no different than any language. If you want to compare based on some specific thing, you have to specify what that is. So here's my compare function. But I'm defining it right here in line as a lambda. See? So I have this strength compare, and it's just a lambda that takes two references to a fighter and tells you whose strength stat is stronger. So this is a really simple comparison function, but you can imagine something a little bit more complicated where it's, you know, if his name starts with, you know, a B and his strength is this, and you could have that be your way of determining ranking. So based on that, I can figure out who my favorite is. So that's what I do. I pick a favorite. And then I say, well, the favorite, this is just another piece of little random math. I'm basically saying the favorite has advantage, right? So if he has a strength of 10 and the other one has a strength of 8, you have the advantage, but you still have a probability of losing of like 20%, basically. And I decrement the health of one fighter. Pretty simple. Again, you'll notice I'm not deleting anything, right? Because all I'm doing is, well, I'm killing my loser. And killing is simply erasing him from my list, right? Removing him from my list. This would be no different in any other language, right? You'd have to remove them from whatever your container is of all the fighters. And that's how we get this kind of fun fighting in the back. I had too much text output before. Whoops. There we go. Now, I talk about genericity and how C++ enables you to do this well. Here's a way of illustrating that. So instead of an array of fighters, right, let me make it a list of fighters, right? And needed will be 2. This will actually, I have to switch to pushback. That was my mistake. So all I wanted to show you is I can make it a list of fighter, and the consuming code, apart from that one assumption about random access, it'll continue to work. So I'm able to write highly generic consumption code of my containers, whether they're vectors, lists, arrays, and I can change the container's definition later if I realize that the performance characteristics that I want are not correct. So instead of a map, I want an unordered map. Like instead of a tree, a hash table, instead of an array, I want a singly linked list. You can do that, and if you take advantage of auto, so I just want to show you how that would look like here. So you know, you'd have for auto it equals f dot begin, right? It not equal to not equal to f dot end plus plus, right? So this code is highly generic. It will work for a vector, it'll work for an array, it'll work for a list, it'll work for anything. Anything that supports forward iteration, which is almost every single container ever. You got to love IntelliSense, right? When it's there, it's really great. So genericity is a core part of the C++ language. And it achieves it through compile time genericity, which is the kind of key difference with other languages. So at compile time, I know that this is a list iterator. And a lot of that type inference and lambda stuff gets inlined as much as possible and directly as kind of the types. There's not a lot of layers of indirection to say dynamically invoke this and that and this and that. So to get back to this, there's one last thing I think I didn't deliver and I wanted to add at the end, which is I talked about power and performance with higher level kind of expressibility. So performance nowadays for sure does not come from a single CPU anymore. If you really want to be fast, you got to go multi-core. And you know, you could spend lots of new talks just talking about parallel programming, whether it's native or managed or anywhere. My colleague Bart DeSmet, I don't know if anyone has gone to his talks, he likes to talk a lot about asynchronous programming, and it's eye-opening, and it's very important for all of us to learn about it. For C++, a lot of the pieces that have come together in this new standard are actually what enable C++ to really play in the game. of concurrency and parallelism. Up until today, 15 years in the making, we now have, you know, a memory model, a way to say what is reordered and what is not, and what is, you know, volatile, and what do those things really mean on all platforms. It used to be kind of platform defined. The standard didn't have to say anything. So that's changed. And then with all these kinds of tools like lambda expressions and genericity, you actually get kind of the ability to write really good parallel code. So I'll give you one example of that with the same code that we were just writing. So I have this GUI app, and I just included the same code in there, and I wanted to show you what I'm doing with it. So same code, and here I am creating an arena on the stack, passing it to a task, which is just a container for a lambda that will then execute in our concurrency runtime in Visual C++ 2010. So this is part of the C runtime now, which is a bunch of parallelism-oriented APIs and a scheduler and a runtime to make that all work really well. And it's cooperative multitasking. So this is saying, make the arena fight to the death. And when that is done, right? So this continue with is like this function that says, when you're done with that, take the result, pass it into as a parameter to this next lambda, and do that. So here I have another lambda that takes a string, which is the type of task, and puts that into a message box. So the reason I'm showing this is a GUI app. Whoops. Need to change my solution. So see, it's responsive. And when I go continuation, it's still responsive. You can still do other things in your application. And when that fight is done, telling me that fighter 6 was victorious, you can do that asynchronously. And you could do other things, right? You could react and change the time or you know, whatever I wanted to do in this application. But asynchrony is one of the key parts of parallelism, right? Parallelism, you could think of it as embarrassingly parallel problems. These are things like taking a for each and making it parallel for each. And we have that in C++. Again, with the same libraries here, I could have shown you an example of that. Another aspect is working on asynchrony, which is tasks and waiting on each other and making that more effective. And that's really what this is about. And that's where the harder part is still. Parallelizing things that are easy to parallelize is not terribly difficult or interesting. It's just we're just getting better at it. And then the third step, once you've mastered both of those two, is is starting to look at kind of newer models of parallel programming around message passing and things like this, which are actually, again, very easy to do in C++ because you can treat things like values. And the key aspect of parallel programming correctly is to deal with values that don't change, that are immutable, and that you can rely upon. That's actually kind of a cornerstone of correct parallel programming. So in summary, you know, we have a new standard. It's huge. I've actually only spoken about 20% of it, maybe. The biggest pieces, for sure, are R-value references, move construction, lambda expressions. These are probably the top two features, but the list is huge, and it's going to take a while for all the compilers that you use to adapt to it. But there's definitely a core set that is starting to become widely available. We have supported lambda expressions and type inference and R-value references since we shipped Visual Studio 2010. And I think over the next couple of years, you're going to see all the compilers kind of take advantage of this standard. And it will definitely change the way we write C++ programs. It's really not the old C++ that we grew up with. And, you know, you can be very successful while writing the higher level expressive kind of things, and that's really important. It's we can get past our legacy of really C-style dangerous programming, and you can have some fun. So go have fun with it. I'm required to put up these slides about, you know, staying up to date and, you know, say something great about me. And you can look about this. Look at this at some other website when it's recorded and it's all good and I look ridiculous. And thank you. So I'd love to take a question or two if that's possible, but yeah? Okay. They said okay. So question, yes, right there. Is there support for detecting cyclic references? This is the eternal question, right? There's debates of emails that go on for pages and pages and pages on our team about this. So detecting cycles automatically, no. And this is where garbage collectors win. If you have types of code that is heavily depending on cycles, GC is going to work better for you. That said, it's probably a bad place to be to have a lot of that kind of code. So what you can do in C++, the solution to that is a weak pointer. Remember I said there are three smart pointers? There's unique, shared, and weak. And weak is basically saying, you know, don't take a ref to that pointer. So that's the way C++ would deal with cycles. Anybody else? Anything? Nope. Okay. What's your favorite C++ feature? Anybody? Yeah. Oh, nice. You're doing this on purpose, aren't you? Yes, variable number of arguments and templates. That's a really, really, really great feature. We don't support it yet. That's why you're good. I'm not going to lie. We don't support it yet. We want it. We want it really, really bad. This is simply a matter of, you know, you can only do so much at a time, and a lot of times you don't want to risk changes happening. So when we were implementing a lot of the features we already have, like lambdas and R-value references, even the standards still had bugs in it, right, in the document. So the spec has actually technically changed, and there's a couple of things that are supposed to work that don't work in 2010, because at the time, even the implementers of the language didn't know yet. So we'll get there. Yeah. And then you can write your Haskell code in templates. This should be a whole talk on metaprogramming at some point next year. Okay. Well, I hope you guys enjoyed that, and I'm happy to take questions here now. Thanks.